Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome to the Sage Sayers. I'm Debbie Gardner-McCullough. I'm an executive communications coach and a narrative coach from New Zealand, based in the fine state of Wisconsin. The Sage Sayers is my weekly podcast where I look at executive communications tips and strategies, and we interview people from all over the globe who've found gifts, opportunities, and knowledge from challenging situations. My guest today is Linda Probaszewski. She's a historian and associate professor of history at the University of Notre Dame. Linda's also a book author of The Republic, According to John Marshall Harlan, editor of Some Memories of a Long Life, and she's a prize-winning dressmaker. So how did I come to know Linda? Well, it's through her beautiful New York Times best-selling book, The Lost Art of Dress, The Woman Who Once Made America Stylish. As someone who loves fashion, and I'm a daughter of a mother who really enjoyed sewing, this book delighted me, and as an executive communications coach, it taught me a lot. The Lost Art of Dress was published with Basic in 2014, but it remains so relevant. In the book, Linda documents the rise of dress doctors in the early 20th century and their demise in the 1960s. So dress doctors, Linda explains within the book, and she'll expand on that for us today, were women working as teachers, writers, retailers, and designers who advised women how to dress well, how to choose clothing which suits us at different times of the day, different life stages, and ages as well. While Linda laments the decline of dress doctors, she felt encouraged by the renewed interest of Americans in dressing well and with taste. And she believes this is an art that Americans learned from dress doctors, but they can learn it again. It was this noticing which inspired her book, The Lost Art of Dress. And Linda, welcome to the Sage Sayers. It's such a pleasure and honor having you with us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I know you're busy with a lot of grading right now, so this is really a special treat having you. I wondered, before we get started on your fabulous book, the work and the journey, if you could just give us a little context on your early starts. Where did you grow up, and what was swirling around you as you grew up?
I grew up outside of Chicago, so a suburb of Chicago. It was the 70s, I think, when I became really aware of fashion. And I was thinking back in thinking about this interview to the, and I don't know what year it was, but I do know that we once showed up at our cousins for Thanksgiving and were absolutely stunned that they had not dressed for Thanksgiving. I.e., they were wearing their regular everyday clothes. They weren't wearing something formal. And we just were in shock. And that's kind of what the 70s were, I think, a time when a lot of people said it shouldn't ever be different from day to day what you wear. And I came to think that was a really bad idea.
Right. And I hear the laughter there. So when you say we noticed, who was there with you? And it was a collective noticing?
Well, it was my family. Literally, my family arrived at my cousin's. I was a kid, and we just sat there with their mouths hanging open because we dressed for Thanksgiving. It's a big holiday, right? We'd always dressed for it before. They had always dressed for it before. So, you know, the idea that making any effort to dress is somehow unnecessary, maybe a bad idea, oppressive or something, I think just came out of the 60s and sort of took its stride in the 70s. And I think that's what happened.
Yeah. I'm going to pause us just for a moment, Linda. If you could just pull your microphone just a little bit further away, it's popping just a little bit.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of.
It's good now, though. I don't hear it now. Okay. Yeah, perfect. Thank you. So I'm thinking of you at the Thanksgiving table with your wonderful woman that you grew up with. What first started your love? Because it sounds like from reading your book, there's two loves going on there. There's a love for history, and then there's your love for beauty and dress. So who among these sewing women, these long line of sewing women from which you emerged, who most inspired you, or is it hard to choose?
Well, I, you know, with my mom, she was there when I was a little kid, and she was a home woman. She wasn't working when I was quite small. And so she made all kinds of things for us. And I guess I found it kind of amazing because I was one of these little kids who love craft kits, right? So my family learned a kid, Linda, the craft kit, because she will want to mess with it. So, you know, there were things my mom made for me. And it was only later on I realized, of course, there was I mean, if you think about sewing is within a larger crafting artisanal culture. So my grandmother made us these little baskets for Halloween, and she had decorated them with felt, which obviously now that I think she'd cut all this out, she'd sewn this together, she'd stuck it to the basket. So I think I came out of, and my father was an engineer, which I actually think matters too, because to me, sewing is a kind of soft engineering. It's
yes,
the same set of principles. So you know, my dad did all kinds of DIY, I guess we would call it now, around the house. But there was just so much making, as it were, that I think was part of my general family background. Everyone had a sewing machine, right? Everybody made things, whether it was sewing or something else.
Yeah. And as you're sharing this delightful memory of this engineering dad and then a stay-at-home mom, but everyone having a sewing machine, I'm remembering glimpses of my own youth when my mom raised my sister and I as a single mother in the wilderness of New Zealand. I just remember the Singer sewing machine she would pull out whenever we needed new clothes. So my very first day at school, at the primary school in Pleasant Point, the nearest village to where we lived, my mother sewed with her foot-pedaled Singer sewing machine. She couldn't afford a pattern at the time, so she used a brown paper bag from the grocery store, folded in half and cut a trapezoid. And then she used curtain fabric to make me an A-line skirt. And I just remember as a kid just loving the sound and just the mechanics of the sewing machine and just complete amazement with what she could create with her hands in that machine.
Yeah, I do think kids, it's kind of magical for kids, obviously, because they don't know how to do it yet. But I do think there's just a pleasure in creating things.
Yeah. And that morning, it was a cold morning, September 5th in New Zealand. Back when I was a child, I was born 1970. You went to school. Your first day of school was on your fifth birthday. So mine was September 5th. And I remember my mom coming out into the living room and she laid out that skirt she was making me that night. And I fell asleep hearing the whirring of the machine. Uh-huh. And when I came out, there it was laid out and some oatmeal knee-high socks to go with it. And it was just this, I couldn't believe she'd made it. And there's some real intrigue and delight for the kids, I think. So describe for us some of your favorite memories of sewing. What was the favorite thing that either your grandmother or your mother sewed for you?
My mom, there were a couple of things I was thinking back on this. My mother made an orange velour zip-up jacket. And I thought it was the coolest thing I had ever worn. I was in grade school, I think, at the time. And the other thing she did, this was knitting, but she had knitted this gathered black skirt, just very simple gathered, but it had stripes around the edges of black and red, red stripes on the black skirt. And I just thought that was the most astonishing thing I owned. It was just so cool, you know.
Amazing. And when we get to high school years, I'm not sure about you, but I know for me, suddenly it was just the one response, the one negative response from one high school friend who said, "I like your slacks" or something. And they were Donna Karan. My mum had sewn them for me. I thought they were amazing, but there was just that one little negative critique. And then that shifted for me. It was maybe 20 years before I started to reappreciate sewing. Was that your experience or not at all?
No. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about how this has changed over the years because I actually have a picture of myself with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court when I gave a talk. And I'm wearing a suit I made. Okay. So, but this is what's funny. Before Ruth Bader Ginsburg got really famous, people would say, "Oh, did you make that jacket or suit?" because they knew about the book. Now they just go, "Oh my God, that's RBG." but I do remember in the 70s, there were people who would say, "Oh, it's homemade." Like that was a bad thing. And since I didn't see what was wrong about these things, because very often they were better.
Of course.
Sitting in a store. And usually, I mean, and I tell people I sew because I'm really fussy. I want something just exactly. I want it to pockets, right? I want it to have this. And most of the time you can't find that. I mean, occasionally I've literally gone online and said, I want a white skirt. I want to do this, 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 this. A half hour later, I said, I could have spent a half hour making the skirt. Why am I even looking? So I have seen the shift, right? I do think the rise of, Project Runway.
Yes. Love that show.
And then Etsy and the whole notion of makers and making has completely shifted any kind of away from any kind of sneeriness. That
I think absolutely right there. And when you think of those episodes where the contestant who doesn't know dressmaking so well, they're the ones who are like, you know, like the challenges ramp up. So you're absolutely right. But it's so delightful to hear. And so I learned a lot about, even though there was I said 20 years earlier, it was probably maybe 10 years before I reappreciated finely made things, especially homemade things. But I did always take away from my mother's sewing this learning. So as I shopped for clothing, for work especially, I would take time to look at how the seams were finished, make sure there were no threads hanging off of it. I understood what good fabric was, and I understood the folly, even as a very young woman, even as 1920 when I left New Zealand, I understood the folly in buying cheap, which would fall apart, and this idea of saving and buying beautiful pieces. I couldn't afford beautiful pieces for a long time, but I understood it. What came to you from seeing, learning to become a seamstress yourself and then the woman who sewed around you?
Well, I'm trying to think back. This was a while ago. But one of the funniest things is you mentioned Donna Karan. And this is actually about patterns. And one of the things I realized looking at her patterns. So she worked for Anne Klein. And Vogue Patterns published Anne Klein patterns for a while that were actually hers. And there were always these little tips or techniques that I hadn't seen before. And I started thinking about, and actually her father was a tailor, which is probably why she had this deeper knowledge, right? A professional knowledge. But as a result, I became quite enamored of her patterns, although I couldn't always afford them in graduate school. But the other funny thing I did, and I think you'll appreciate this, talking about going out into retail, I couldn't buy these either. But the nice women at Nordstrom's never yelled at me when I asked if I could try on. So, I mean, they'd come up to you and say, do you want to try this? I go look at the Donna Karan suits and just look at them, right? Look inside them. And they'd say, why don't you try them on? And I did. And I would try on Donna Karan dresses and Donna Karan suits at this really fancy store. Stanford University is next to an extremely expensive suburb. And I would notice the things that they did, right? The overlap on a wrap dress, which was so much smarter than anything I had seen in a pattern, for example. So I kind of took notes on what she could do, both in the patterns and then in the retail, because I noticed smart techniques. And I thought, wait, I want to learn how to do those.
Beautiful. So interesting. So let's start talking about your beautiful book. So at what point did you see the vision for The Lost Art of Dress? And you noted in the opening chapters that Americans can come across as sloppy dresses compared with others. And I say that with complete affection. I've lived in this country since 1996, but my American husband even says that too when he goes to Europe and then comes back. So he does that comparison. So when did you notice the comparative difference to other cultures? And then secondly, what was that aha moment, kind of that epiphany that this could become a book?
Well, I guess I noticed in airports. And I was trying to remember which airport, and I don't know. I speak French, and I've been to France a few times, and it must have been in one of the airports going to or from the country that I did notice that we just, well, had, someone once said, you know, it looks like we've come to mow the lawn.
That's really funny.
I think that was David Sedaris said that. I don't want to claim that joke, but it's true. I always think we look like we've come to clean the garage, but you know, the idea for the book, literally, and I tell this story in the book, and it's true. I found a book in an old used bookstore called Clothes for You. And I started reading it. I thought, oh my gosh, we used to be taught how to dress. And we were. And that's when I got the idea for the book. I just started reading these things because I just thought they were fascinating. And the other thing I realized as I read, and even though, right, I had been sewing, I had been around patterns and sewing my whole life, I had never seen one of these systematic books where they laid out, you know, the principles of art, the occasions for dress. And while I was looking at all this, I thought, it's systematic, right? It's they thought about everything. And then they put it into books and we completely forgot about it, which is also a reason why I say to people when I give public talks, there'll be a lot of older women in the group and they're like, what's with these kids? What, don't you think they just dress terrible? And I say, well, you were taught how to dress.
Right.
And they weren't. So you don't get to yell at people for not knowing something that no one offered to teach them.
Yes.
So, I started collecting the books for myself because I found them fascinating. And when they had sewing technique in them too, I learned things. And then I started using vintage patterns and I found them fascinating because I was learning techniques from them too. And, I realized that there might actually be I started teaching a class. But then I realized there might actually be a public audience for this. So it just developed from a book and from a book collection and then from a class. And then there we go.
Beautiful. So as you did this deep dive into these forgotten dress doctors and you had that passion inside of you on this overarching principles of this advice piece and the vitality of that, what became the most surprising findings of your research on the dress doctors?
I guess I was surprised they existed and that this was systematically taught. I guess I just never, I'm an academic. I know a lot about academics, right? And I had never heard of these people. And they'd come out of the land-grant universities and they had, right, been teaching all of this. And then all of it got forgotten. So that to me was the real shock of it. The other thing that surprised me, but it made perfect sense, was, of course, these were professional women in eras when there were very few public arenas of activity that women were allowed to work in. And they were worried about how we can work, right? And how do you present yourself professionally? How do you do that? And I thought that was very valuable too, because it always seemed to me that men's professional clothing is like this tiny little spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And women's clothing is a huge spectrum, right? I mean, we really don't have a backless dress for men. We don't have that equivalent.
Right.
And the problem is a lot of our spectrum is actually all date clothing, right? Seduction at various levels or, right, trying to get attention in a dark room. When really, most of the time, we're not in a dark room. We're not trying to seduce anyone. We've got a lot of work to do.
I love that. Well, and two, and I'm thinking about one of my favorite brands for work clothing is Theory, New York-based brand. I think Tahari and another designer combined their skills to create Theory. But a lot of the work clothing I've noticed lately is very seductive. I'm like, wait a minute, this is like a micro mini. It's a beautiful A-line 60s inspired dress with a scoop neck and a beautiful drop sleeve and a little bit of bell. And it A-lines out. But then it's like almost showing you knickers, Linda. You can't even if you sat down, it would ride up. And then... Yeah. If you're presenting, you'd feel so distracted. Am I being old-fashioned there?
No. I honestly feel sorry for young women, right? I teach college women. And most of what they're offered is exhibiting form and flesh in ways we never ask men to do. Never. Right? And unfortunately, I think... How could I put this? The Harvey Weinsteins of this world and the other men in Hollywood who have decided that women are only attractive when they're mostly naked.
Right.
We need to move. We need to explode that world. We need to undo that world and realize. And that's why I absolutely love so many of these vintage patterns. they're not super erotic and they're absolutely beautiful.
They're so beautiful. I love the 60s cuts, especially for work fashion. They're some of my favorites. Just the simplicity of the cuts, but for a more modest length.
Yeah.
Is how I would.
Well, I say to my students, always ask yourself, is there a male equivalent? And if there isn't, why not?
There you go. So how are we doing for time? Do you have like another 8 minutes?
Sure.
Okay, great. So I wondered, as you became this expert on the lost art of dress, did you find yourself, did that kind of up your game a little bit in terms of how you had to put yourself together for public appearances? Or, and the other sub question is, did you have to resist offering unsolicited advice, or did that just not come up?
No, this is what's so funny. Okay. I do sometimes think, oh, right, you have a public now. So right. not so much for presentations, because actually, before I even started on this book, I love suits. I just love tailoring. I think it looks sharp, competent, well put together. So I love a tailored suit. And there was a point where I literally had to give myself permission to wear them at work because nobody else did it. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, I don't care what they're wearing.
I love because, that piece.
Well, because these sets look good and they look, but it's not just, and I don't want to say that I don't care what people think of what I'm wearing. I'm not going to wear something inappropriate. The whole idea is, to me, those suits did look appropriate. They gave me a look of competence, a look of authority. I felt good in them. I'd made them. And that's the other thing I said. I made these beautiful suits. Why aren't I wearing them? And it's because everyone else was wearing separates. And I thought, well, who cares? I can wear them. So yes. And I often wore suits. So why not? Why not?
Well, and the piece, and we're getting to some advice in just a moment, but I think the piece for me, I have a wonderful friend and mentor, Dr. Heidi Schultz, and she's a professor at Kenan Flagler Business School, associate professor. And we often discuss, we have a mutual love for fashion and the thrill of the chase and finding the items that really build our executive presence. Because when you're presenting or you're sharing your ideas, I feel like what I put on really changes how I feel as I share my ideas.
Yeah.
And it's not really coming from a place of sexism and feeling like I'm a woman, I really need to go the extra mile. It's not really coming from that. It's quite the opposite. It's I'm a woman and I have a huge value around aesthetics and beauty and creativity, but also I need to feel confident. And when I put on something lovely that I know compliments me and feels appropriate for my audience, I do present much more, not with authority, but just a place of comfort. And it really starts to fight the imposter syndrome that comes up inevitably when you're in front of a crowd and having to share your ideas. That's inevitable for all presenters, right? A little bit will come up. When I take the time to dress up a little bit and think thoughtfully about my audience and how I want to appear to them, it does help me manage imposter syndrome too.
Well, and the dress doctor said this. They said, look, you get these lessons down, you get your wardrobe out, you make sure it suits your life, and then you can stop thinking about it, right? Because you are going into the world and you've got things to do. They didn't really want people. That's what's so interesting. They did not want people to obsess around about their clothing, which is why they wanted to say, here are the lessons, apply them, get what you need. You can have fun with fashion. But get what you need to suit your life and then get on with it.
Right, right. And I believe that can be done on a budget too. I have done it on a budget. Yeah. I've done it on a very low income and still managed that. Two last questions. One is of the part, I mean, I just love the whole book, but it's been a while since I've read it. I'll be transparent here. Can you remind me and share with my listeners what are the – in terms of the timing and the situation, what are the core rules as women we ought to be thinking about in terms of if we were to align ourselves with their rules, the dress doctors laid out rules, what were the three core ones that come to mind?
Spend your money on the clothing you spend the most time in.
Interesting.
Always make sure you have something beautiful for yourself at the end of a workday.
What do they mean by that? Like just put on something really...
Whatever you like. I mean, I have to say the lounge, the vintage loungewear from the 50s back, even the hostess gowns, they're so beautiful. But the idea is that you deserve something beautiful. It's not just a public face. It's for you. It's for those you love.
So for to flounce in, just to feel feminine.
Just because it's beautiful.
Oh, how gorgeous. Okay, what's the other one?
I was just thinking of this third one. I would say, and this actually connects to that last one, which is use your clothing to signal what you're doing. And I say that because they would say, okay, work, right? No sleeves that will fall into your typewriter when they had typewriters, or into your soup when you got to lunch. That's always been my biggest problem. But also that idea of, and sometimes you're not working anymore. And I actually think with so many people able to work from home and the ability of your employer to get at you at any hour of the day, you should be allowed to take off the serious, competent looking suit or whatever it is you're wearing, the serious clothing, the sober clothing, and to put on something that says, you know what? I get to play now.
Beautiful.
And I don't have to pick up the email anymore.
I love that, Linda. Last question. When we're working from home, as many of us are, and many of my clients and friends are in back-to-back meetings, what are some good best practices that we can incorporate to still look and feel good, even though we're working from home, and especially in a professional setting when we're on a video call?
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because I don't demand everyone wear suits all the time if they're not comfortable in them. In fact, you know what I really love? They call it the jardigan. It's the cardigan that looks like a jacket. I've seen
this. You mean like the belted one, the beautiful belted
one?
It's beautiful.
Mostly to stay warm because we keep the heat so low. There's no reason why you can't be comfortable. See, that to me is always so interesting. People will say, oh, but my clothes are comfortable, so I don't have to dress for this or that. And I say, well, I'm not wearing anything uncomfortable. I don't know why you would think I would. To me, the real question is there a certain level of polish? And I realize this has been so draining for everyone. But at the same time, you kind of want to say, look, it's good for you to just make that little effort. Mark your day. Mark your work day, right? I'm going to wear this during the work day, and then I'm done at whatever time it is or whatever hours you get off. You don't have to wear that stuff anymore. I think it's a good signal to say to yourself, go relax and stop worrying about all this for a while, if you can, obviously.
And then put on something beautiful.
And something beautiful, because you deserve it.
You deserve it. Yeah. I love that. Well, Linda, it's been such a pleasure having you with me on my show today. I wondered in closing if you wanted to let my listeners know how they can find you and tell us about your new book.
Okay. So I actually blog on Tumblr. On fashion, vintage and modern fashion, Monday through Friday. So you can always find me there. I repost it on Facebook at the end of the week. The new book is called Who Won the Bible War? And it's completely different. I'm a legal historian by training. And it looks at a case from the 19th century where they took the Bible out of the public schools and literally and possibly figuratively all hell broke loose.
Wow. So when is that one publishing?
Got to finish it first.
Oh, yes. Well, it's been just a delight to find you, Linda. Thank you for coming to my show. You've been listening to Debbie Gardner-McCullough. I'm an executive communications coach and a narrative coach from New Zealand, and I'm based in the fine state of Wisconsin. If you'd like to visit my site to book me for a complimentary session on communications training and coaching or narrative coaching, visit my website at hangingrockcoaching.com. Thanks for now, and we'll see you next week.